This is us. It's just me. Minu, my wife, unfortunately, my mother-in-law has been unwell and she's had to go home and look after her. You got the short straw. She's much better than me. That's our daughter, Ellie, who is running feral on the site somewhere. Lord only knows what she's doing. Back when the world was young, I was a youth worker, helped plant Soul Survivor Watford, helped set up Soul Survivor. Still part of the leadership of Soul Survivor. Worked for an organization for a long time called Tear Fund. And now work with something called International Justice Mission. Who has heard of International Justice Mission? Put your hands in the air if you've heard of International Justice Mission before I just said it. Go on, put your hands up. Everybody else, look around and see the people whose hands are in the air. Go on, keep your hands up if you've heard. Look at them. These are the people going to heaven. But it's not too late to join them. So what we want to look at is how we change the world. That was kind of the context in which Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. But how are we going to change the world? And we're going to look at that by taking one issue and one story. The issue is going to be slavery, and the story is obviously the story of the Good Samaritan. So we know that in history there was the transatlantic slave trade. People from the UK and actually other northern European countries would sail to West Africa, would steal or buy people who would transport them to the Caribbean and to the Americas and bring back cotton and sugar and things like that, produce from those countries and sell it here. And it was abolished by William Wilberforce, or by a movement led by William Wilberforce 200 years ago. So here's a little question. So just because it is late in the afternoon, here's a little quiz. There are more slaves now than ever before, true or false? Could everyone stand up? I know that's made you hate me now. But could everyone stand up? Okay, and have a stretch. Honestly, it really is the last day, isn't it? Because you're standing up going, oh, God. So, would you sit down if you think that statement is false? Okay, so most of you think that statement is true. Yeah? Okay, please sit down. It is true. There are more slaves in the world today than ever before. It's by its very nature, it's very hard to make an accurate count, but the most recent one, actually the most recent one was 47.3 million. But it's something over 45 million people currently enslaved today. While we're in this seminar, 90 children will be sold. And like if you were in the main meeting last night, remember like I said last night, they'll be sold into sweatshops and brothels and factories. And we believe they should be in families and playgrounds and schools. But 90 children, while we're in this seminar, will be sold. 5 million people this year in total will be sold. And that is a horrific statistic, isn't it? That is a really horrific statistic. Let me tell you about Rupa. And Rupa is in India. So what do you notice about this story? Rupa says that until she was 6 years old, she has really happy memories. At 6 years old, her family were offered a job. Her dad and mum were offered a job, and they were offered a job in a brick kiln, making bricks. That's what you do in a brick kiln. And they thought this would be a great moment for them. They thought this would be a really, really great job opportunity that would give their family a better life. But it wasn't. It wasn't a dream. It was a nightmare. So instead of getting manageable work and good pay, her family were forced to mold and haul thousands of heavy clay bricks. Their working day was 2 a.m. until 9 p.m. Children were made to push carts laden with sand, and there was no time for school or rest or play. If a family missed their 1,000 a day brick quota, they would be beaten and abused. There wasn't much food. Rupa remembers sadly that her parents cooked for her and her brother, but they would often go to sleep with an empty stomach. There was constant abuse. The kiln owner and his family used to flaunt their wealth in front of the slaves. They'd eat luxurious food. They would lounge around. And they would sexually harass the young women. One of Rupa's saddest memories is seeing her mother repeatedly sexually abused with no one to help. In order to try and protect their daughter, Rupa's parents arranged for her to marry a young man also in the kiln called Bananiah. He had also grown up in slavery, and he tried his best to give them a good home. What happened was when she got married, she was taken to a different part of the brick kiln and didn't see her parents anymore. So she didn't know until they came to beat her and Bananiah that her parents had managed to escape. When Rupa was 16 years old, she was pregnant with her first child. Even though she was pregnant, her work quota wasn't changed, and her tasks were kept up at the same relentless pace. In her 8th month of pregnancy, there was an accident in the kiln that sent Rupa into early labour. There was no doctor or medical care, and for a day and a half, she bled and cried in agony on a mud floor in their little shack until delivering a stillborn baby. Again, no medical help. And 1 week later, she was forced back to work. She was still bleeding, she recalls. She was in a lot of pain. But she was not allowed to take rest. And having given birth to a stillborn child, that just gave them another set of verbal abuse to throw at her. A few years later, she became pregnant again. And this time, Bananiah decided to take on the entire family workload himself in order that Rupa would be able to rest. They were desperate not to lose another child. And Vijay was born, healthy and well. Again, amazing, with no medical help at all. But having a little baby made this couple think about what they could do for the future. And they decided that they needed to escape, that they couldn't bring up their child in the same slavery that they had been brought up in. So they ran. They took an opportunity one night, ran into the countryside, into the bush that were around them, in the forest nearby. And for 6 months, they survived. They survived by gathering fruits and nuts and whatever in the forest. They survived by collecting firewood and selling bits of firewood, always in fear that the slave owner, the kiln owner, would see them and recapture them. And that's what happened. One day they had to go to the village because Vijay needed to see a doctor. They were waiting to see the doctor, and Bananiah left to go find them some food. That's when the kiln owner spotted Rupa and Vijay and dragged them back to the kiln. Rupa was immediately forced back to work in the owner's home and taunted and abused by his henchmen. You can imagine what was going through Benaiah's mind as he came back to find his wife and child gone. He was beside himself. But that panic and that frustration and that desperation meant he stopped hiding and started talking, and he started looking for help. And that's when he came across IJM. His information led to investigation of what was going on, undercover people going in to film, to gather evidence. It led to taking that evidence to local police and explaining what was happening. It led to working with the local police and the prosecutors to plan a rescue on that brick kiln. And one day, in November 2015, a raid was done, and Rupa and Vijay and loads of others were set free. The kiln owner and his henchmen are in the legal system facing prosecution. We're praying that they'll get convicted. Benaiah and Rupa entered an aftercare program. Remember, they'd lived in slavery for almost all their lives. And in that aftercare program, as well as counseling and prayer and all of that kind of stuff, there's also skills training and vocational training. Benaiah today has a good job in a manufacturing plant near their home. Rupa takes care of 2-year-old Vijay and is learning tailoring skills so that she can work in that way in the future. And just 6 months after her rescue, she agreed to share her story and be a spokesperson to other families and women from her community to warn them of what might happen when someone comes along and offers you a job that seems too good to be true. That's Rupa's story, a real story from the last couple of years. So I wonder if you would turn to the person next to you, or the little groups of you. Some of you will now hate me even more than making you stand up, for making you talk to people. But this is really going to happen. We're going to do group work. Yay! Do you know, the seething hatred I'm feeling in the room makes me think we need the ministry team here now. What I want you to do is just share what you noticed from Rupa's story, okay? Just what you noticed. As I said, it could be how slavery happened. It could be what needed to happen to make it better. It might be what you felt about what you heard. But just a couple of minutes to share what you noticed, and we're going to take a little bit of feedback. Who wants to share what they were noticing? I will come and mercilessly just put the microphone in front of people. I have no shame in these things. So who would like to share what they noticed? You made the mistake of catching my eye.
I found it a bit weird how they, instead of like going straight for help after coming out of the factory, going straight for help, but just staying in the woods and eating up nuts and fruits. I'm just wondering why they just didn't get help in the first place.
It's funny, isn't it? People who are trafficked are brutalized, and they are often told that no one will believe them, first of all. Same with things like child abuse, isn't it? No one will believe them. It will be their fault. They're made to believe that they have been bought fairly, and therefore, if they go to the authorities, they'll just be taken back to the slave owner. But that sense of isolation and no one can help me is really powerful at keeping people locked up, isn't it, in their situations. Great, you're all looking terribly distant from me at the moment. Yes, sir.
We wondered if it's something that they'd be able to get away with in this country, and whether the authorities and whether there were measures in place that prevented it happening in those countries, whether it is easier to get away with that sort of thing in those sorts of nations and less easy to get away with in this sort of nation.
Great. Is it easier to get away with it in other countries of the world? So certainly, we're going to go on to look a little bit about that. But certainly the Home Office here says there's at least 13,000 slaves in the UK. Mostly in the UK. Some of that is sex trafficking and brothels. But mostly in the UK, it's about agricultural labour. And you're most likely to bump into trafficked people and people held in slavery in nail bars and car washes and places where you don't have much interaction with people, and it's all cash, and you're not sure where these people come from and where they're going to. But yes, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Go on then.
Oh. You were really hoping I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. I can't remember what I said. Oh, yeah, I thought it was weird how no one noticed them being taken from the doctors the second time they got taken.
Yeah, or maybe people did notice and they just didn't care. So one of the things about slavery is that it often happens to people that other people don't care about. they come from a particular ethnic group or a caste in India, people that we just don't care about. Yeah? So that's a really good point. Anybody else want to share something? Yes.
We were just talking about how it seemed quite easy for people to be exploited in order for others to gain money, wherever you are in the world.
That's really good. That's really, really helpful. It is incredibly easy for people to exploit people for gain and for that to seemingly be okay. Let me pull some of those things together. These are the things I noticed. This is how slavery happens. It happens when poverty meets greed meets opportunity. So Rupert's family were really poor. And when someone came along and offered them a chance for a different job, they were desperate enough to believe the best, even though they might have been worried. And that's true all across poor communities. The nice, plausible person, man or woman, comes along and offers someone a job or offers someone the chance to go to school. I met a girl a couple of months ago in the Philippines called Cassie, and she had been held captive to take part in sex acts over the internet directed by people in, actually in her case, in the UK and in Northern Europe. Her parents had given her to a distant relative who had promised her when she was 14 that he would pay for her to go to school. And he did pay for her to go to school. That kept up the normalcy. But in the evenings and at the weekends, she was subjected to to terrible abuse. I met a man in northern Thailand who'd sold one of his daughters to a brothel in Bangkok for a year. And there's only one question to ask a father who sold his daughter to a brothel for a year, and that's why. And his answer stunned me. Because he said through the translator, he said, by selling her for a year, I was able to pay for the rest of my children to go to school and for us to live for a year. What would you do? What a horrific choice to have to make, isn't it, as a father, as a parent? What a horrific choice. I'd like to think that I would make a different choice. But the power of poverty is one of the drivers of why slavery happens. People are desperately poor and are looking for a way out. And there's all kinds of organisations working on poverty. We've made great advances in reducing absolute poverty over the last 30 years. And you can go around the tool shed and find organisations that are working on that. But poverty persists with us, and poverty will continue to persist. So the second thing that makes slavery possible is greed, like the lady was saying. That brick kiln owner didn't want to pay wages, didn't want to treat people properly. That brick kiln owner was greedy. And greed drives slavery, where people think they can make money out of other people, and it doesn't matter how they treat them. And as I said, often that involves treating people from a different race or a different caste or a different social group because they don't matter as much. But the third reason for slavery is opportunity. That brick kiln owner thought he could grab Rupa and Ajay from the doctors and get away with it because he had no thought that the police would stop him. He had no thought that this would be a crime. It was an opportunity. We in this country, the question was asked, is it easier to be, is slavery more of a problem in different parts of the world than here? Well, yes, because it might sometimes be clunky and it might sometimes be slow, but we actually have a justice system. We have an act of parliament called the Modern Slavery Act, which sets down very strict penalties and a legislative framework to fight slavery. We have a police force, which if you ring them up and say, I think human trafficking is going on, they are likely to investigate. But all of this is still comparatively recent here in the UK, because often it's people from Roma communities who are trafficked to the UK, or Chinese, or from very far Eastern Europe. And they're people that get despised often. So people don't report it because those people don't matter as much. And that ties in, and we're not going to go there, that ties into the whole debates we have about how we view migrants and asylum seekers and so on. So there's opportunity. The thing that stopped Rupa's enslavement was when that opportunity was taken away. We couldn't fix the poverty at a vast scale. We can't fix the greed in people's hearts until they give their lives to Jesus. But we can fix the opportunity. The Modern Slavery Commissioner for Kent and Essex Police said to me that in her patch, Kent and Essex of this country, there are three major organised crimes. And by value, by the amount of money you get from them, the number one would be, what would you guess? Most profitable bit of organised crime. Sorry? Drugs, absolutely. Drugs is number one. Do you know what number three is? Sorry? Slavery is not number three. Slavery is number two. What's number three? It's really surprising. That's why I asked you. Arms dealing. Weapons. He said, if you're an organised criminal, your most profitable activity is drugs. Second most profitable activity is people trafficking and slavery. Third most profitable activity is selling weapons. Then she said this. She said, in this country, this is a few months ago she said this to me. He said, in this country, if you sell drugs and weapons, you've got a lot of law enforcement after you. If you sell people, not so much. Opportunity. The numbers are bigger. In India, bonded labour, slave labour, like Rupa's, about 28 million people, according to the Indian government. So it's bigger numbers, but it's the same issue. So in the face of this reality, Jesus tells a story. And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And it's one of the most famous stories, isn't it? It's one of the top three Jesus stories that he told. And we know it really well. A man was walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. And as Jesus started this story, the crowd would have gone, oh, what an idiot walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. Everyone knows that road is terrible. That road's awful. That road is dangerous. Well, I hope he wasn't on his own. And Jesus goes on to say, and he fell amongst thieves who mugged him and robbed him. And everyone would have gone, oh, those thieves, could have told you that was going to happen. Always happens on that road. Terrible. And then Jesus continued and said, but then coming down the road was a priest. And all the crowd had gone, yay, a priest. Just like that. It's in the Greek. You see, later on, more of you will laugh at that joke than just did now. Then said, yay, a priest, he'll do what's right. And Jesus said, and the priest didn't see, walked by on the other side. And the crowd had gone, ha, priests, could have told you that. Just swan around the temple at Jerusalem all day long doing nothing. And then Jesus said, and then a Levite came along the road, and the crowd said, yay, Levite, they're the ones who do all the work, he'll sort it all out. And Jesus says, and the Levite didn't see, and he walked by on the other side, and all the crowd had gone, huh, who'd have guessed? And then Jesus said, and then a Samaritan came down the road. And at the mention of the word Samaritans, most of the crowd would have snarled and grumbled, and some would have spat on the floor and swore, because the Jews hated the Samaritans and vice versa. And the crowd would have begun mumbling, oh, the Samaritan coming on. This is getting bad from bad to worse for this poor man. The Samaritan will probably go over there, kick him, beat him up a bit more, see if the robbers left anything. And then Jesus says, but the Samaritan saw and went and bound his wounds and looked after him and took him to an inn where he could rest and paid for him. And all the crowd would have gone, what is that about? Jesus told that story in response to a question. And the question was, what's the most important commandment? And Jesus said, oh, it's easy. The most important commandment, in fact, all the commandments are summed up in these two things. Just two things you have to do to be perfect. Just two. Number one, love the Lord your God with everything inside of you. And number two, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Easy. Do those two things and you are perfect. That is all the law and all the prophets, Jesus said. The guy who asked him the question felt a bit kind of put out by this and felt it should be a bit more complicated. And so he said to Jesus, so who is my neighbor? If I've got to love my neighbor as myself, who is my neighbor? And you kind of get that sense of where does this love thing have to stop? You know, is it my actual neighbor? Is it my town? Is it my ethnic group? Is it my nation? Who do I have to love, Jesus? And Jesus tells him this story. And at the end of the story, Jesus turns his question round, because he turns to the man who'd asked him, who is my neighbor? And he turns to the man and he says to him, so you tell me, who was the neighbor? Who acted like a neighbor to this person? And the man said, grudgingly, well, it was the one who did something. The Samaritan. Do you see what Jesus did? So the man was saying, what's the limit of who I have to love? And Jesus said, will you be the kind of person who loves regardless, who loves relentlessly, who loves beyond boundaries? Will you be the kind of person who, when you see people in need, you will act? Because that's the kind of Christian love. That's the kind of love that the followers of Jesus are called to display. And what he was saying was, you've got to notice, you've got to decide to care, and you've got to do something. You've got to notice what's going on. You've got to decide that it matters to you, and you've got to do something. That's what the Good Samaritan did. He noticed the guy on the road, he decided to care, and he acted. Because the start of the problem is that people are unseen, that we don't know how to notice people. So I talked about situations in this country where you get cash businesses with people who don't speak very good or any English, who are kept isolated, separated from normal society, and you have no idea what their situation is, how they got here, whether they're getting paid, whether they're held in slavery. And that's true, and we should be noticing all of those things. But there's something else we can do to notice. So what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to find the person next to you, and I want you to find a care label on an item of clothing. Okay? Number one, choose your item of clothing carefully. This is a Christian camp. And number two, for the men here, the care label is a magic piece of information on some clothes which tells you how to wash them. So I want you to find a care label. What we're looking for is, where were your clothes made? So when you found a country where it says made in, can you shout it out so I can hear it? China, I've had. Bangladesh. India. Vietnam. Turkey. Portugal. Another India, another Bangladesh. Spain, wow. El Salvador. Yeah. South Africa. Okay, who had, I heard one person at least. Sorry? Yeah, I was just about to say, who has something made in the UK? Wow, who knew that we made anything anymore? There's a miracle. What did most of those countries have in common? Cheap labor, poor, yeah? So I know that you have all been admiring my shirt. Yeah, exactly, it's nice. You think it suits me, you like the cut of it, you like the color and the pattern. Just go with me on this. The thing is, my hands weren't the first to touch my shirt. In fact, the shop assistants who put the shirt on the rack weren't the first hands to touch this shirt either, nor the people who packaged it up and unpacked it at the ports. They weren't the first people. Someone made this shirt. Someone picked the cotton. Someone mixed the dyes. someone sat in a factory and worked the machine that wove this shirt. Were they paid? Was the place they were working, was that safe? Were there fire exits? Was the safety equipment on the looms, or had it been taken off so they'd go faster but be more dangerous? Who sewed the buttons on? Was it a child? Because their little fingers are good at little buttons. Who made my clothes? Who made your clothes? Martin Luther King said, before we finish breakfast, we've relied on half the world. And what he meant was, someone had picked the oranges for our orange juice. Someone had picked the cereals that got processed into Weetabix and Special K and all the others. We've relied on people to make our lives work. Were they slaves? Or were they honoured workers? And the truth is, we don't know, do we? So we have to ask. So this is your first takeaway from this seminar. If you want to join the front line of the fight against slavery, next time you go and buy, let's talk about clothes. Next time you go and buy some clothes, you pick out what you like and what suits you and you like the fit and all the rest of it. And you go to the counter and you say, I want this. But before I buy it, could you please tell me if slaves were involved in the production of this shirt or trousers or shoes or whatever it is? And the shop assistant will look at you, not knowing whether to giggle or call security. And so you persist, and eventually they either write something down, which might make it to the customer service department, or they give you the email address to write to. And you go home and you take the moment, the couple of minutes, to write to the customer service department. And you say, I love your clothes, and I want to buy them, but I need to know were slaves involved in the production of those clothes. Do you know, every big company in the UK now, by law, has to be able to have a good answer to that question. So you go and ask it. I want to give you an example. 20 years ago, I moved into a new town, and it had the most enormous Tesco's I'd ever seen at that point. And in this enormous Tesco's, there was one brand of fair trade coffee that you could buy. And it was disgusting. We only ever bought that brand of fair trade coffee so we could give it to visitors so they'd think we were the kind of people who bought fair trade coffee. But every time I went in, I'd go up to the customer service desk and I would say, I'd like to buy more fair trade coffee. In fact, I'd like to buy more fair trade things. Could you do more fair trade? And they'd kind of roll their eyes out loud and we'd fill in the little form and off we go. And I and loads of other people did that in our Tesco's. And today, in my massive Tesco's, it is impossible to buy non-fair trade coffee. There's loads of brands, and they're all some certification of different sorts of fair trade. Now, I believe that Mr. Tesco's is a lovely man who wants to do the right thing. I also know that Mr. Tesco's knows how to count money. And he will sell us what we want. Marketing directors spend a fortune trying to find out what we care about. As consumers, we have the most unbelievable power. And when we voluntarily tell them what we care about, that makes a difference. If enough of us kept asking, can you tell me whether there were slaves involved in the production of this shirt? Can you tell me how the workers were treated? Can you? As soon as people realize there's enough people who care about that, they will act and do something. That's the number one thing from this takeaway. But what if we could fix the road, not just the person? The great thing about the story of the Good Samaritan is the Good Samaritan was there and that guy who was mugged got helped. What about the guy who came down the road the next day and the day after and the day after that? How can we change the system? How can we make a complete difference? So in Southeast Asia in the early 2000s, International Justice Mission was working and child sex trafficking was everywhere. People from Northern Europe and America used to travel there to abuse children. And the solution was to start convicting people. The solution was to start convicting people, locking people up. We did, I'm not going to show you all the graphs because we've run out of time. We did, the Gates Foundation paid for some research. And over 4 years in the Philippines, in the three places where we were working, the involvement of children in the sex industry dropped by 80%. And it dropped by 80% because the people who were selling children for sex got arrested and convicted. So they weren't doing it anymore. And it dropped because as soon as criminals thought this was a dangerous business to be in, they stopped entering it. We can make a difference. We can fix the road. And how that works, I said a little bit about this last night, but how that works is that today there's an investigator posing as a punter in a brothel. And they're wired up with hidden cameras and audio. And I've seen lots of this video feed they've got, and that's disgusting. But they go there to gather evidence. And they try and negotiate the price for a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. Get it on video. Incredibly dangerous. They take that to the legal team, who work with the police to try and build up a case. Now, in lots of parts of the world, there's lots of corruption and there's lots of collusion, but in every part of the world, there are good people seeking to protect the vulnerable and do the right thing. And our guys find those people and they help them build up a case, which leads to a raid and a rescue, which leads to an arrest and a prosecution, which leads to a conviction. It's relentless work. And the way that we can participate in that relentless work is through prayer. If we're going to knock on the doors of sweatshops and brothels and factories, we need to knock on the door of heaven. We need to ask the Holy Spirit to protect those investigators, to give insight to those prosecutors, to give wisdom to the aftercare workers. And we can all do that. Jesus said, "Who will be a neighbor?" And we can be a neighbor by certainly asking about how we spend our money and the clothes we buy and the food we buy and so on. We can be a neighbor by noticing around us where there are communities of people who look like they are isolated and controlled by others. But we can be a neighbor by going to our Father in persistent prayer and praying for the end of slavery. And if you went over to the hub where the information and the bookshop is, there's a little walkthrough experience which explains a little bit about how slavery works but ends up in prayer. And what we are asking you to do this year at Soul Survivor is, will you commit to every week praying just for a few minutes? We'll give you the real-time, real prayer needs. These raids are happening. This stuff is going on. We'll give you that information, and will you cover those people in prayer? Because when we do that, we can make this the last generation of slaves. We've run out of time, so a final story. A friend of mine was involved in rescues, and one day, it was in India, but one day they went to a quarry. And they'd done all the work and all the research, they'd got the evidence, and on this particular day, the police and the social workers and my friend and his organization turned up in order to do a rescue, and they found over 100 slaves held in this quarry. And they began processing everyone, trying to work out where everyone was from and who belonged to whom and everything. And they did all of that, and there were 3 children left over. The oldest girl was maybe around 10, 8, 6. That's what they looked like. They'd only arrived a month or two earlier, and nobody knew much about them. The owner had just bought them, and the owner wasn't talking. People presumed they were siblings because they'd come together, but no one knew. But 3 little vulnerable children. And so they didn't expect to find 3 leftover children. So they were scrambling to find an appropriate care home for them to go to, a safe place for them to go to get help and start getting resettled. And so my friend and one of the social workers eventually found a place and put these 3 children in the back of the car and started taking them to this place. And there was silence for a while. And then the oldest girl very tentatively said, "What's happening to us? Where are you taking us?" And my friend and the social worker began to explain, you have been held illegally and we've come to rescue you and we're going to take you to somewhere that's safe where you'll be looked after. A few minutes later, the girl says, are we in trouble? We're sorry if we've done something wrong. Are you going to hurt us? Because that had been her life. And my friend and the social worker began to explain, no, you're not in trouble. We're not going to hurt you. You have been rescued. You're going to go to somewhere where you're going to be looked after. We're going to make sure you're healthy and well. You're going to get good food. In due course, you'll go to have the opportunity to go to school. We're going to try and find out where you came from and see if we can reunite you with your family. She fell silent. Another few minutes went past. Please don't beat us. We'll do anything you want. Please don't make us be in trouble. What's happening to us? They went through again and again and again. At one point, they thought they were hungry, so they gave them bananas. These children are in India. They were given the bananas, and they didn't know what to do with them because they'd never had a banana. Every few minutes, this girl, who the oldest one, who was acting as the spokesperson, asked about their situation. My friend said he explained, that she had been held and they had been held against their will and that was wrong, and that they were going to a place of safety where they would be looked after. And he said, we have not come to take you to another place to work. What we do is we rescue people like you. And she fell silent for a few minutes and then she just said, what took you so long? 90 children while we've been in this seminar. 5 million this year. 45 million plus held in slavery. What takes us so long? Can we not spare a couple of minutes to check who made our clothes? Can we not commit to pray a few minutes a week for those at the front line of slavery and join them there before our Father? Let the blessings we've received here at Soul Survivor echo around the world to those who are held in great darkness and in great fear.